the Israelis erected in Jerusalem was very similar to many of the pagan temples in the surrounding countries. Many of the pagan temples had an outer court and an inner court. And then at the center of the inner court, they had the sacred place, and then within the sacred place, the most sacred place of all. And, of course, the temple that the people of Israel erected on Mount Zion, the king, usually golden gods, god of war, the goddess of fertility. And at the heart of Israel's religion, in that sacred center, there was a golden box. And in that golden box, among other things, were the tablets of the law given to Moses on Mount Sinai. I don't know what you do with that information. One of the things it would tell you is that the thing that separates the religion from the Bible from the pagan religions that surrounded it was not in the shape of its architecture. Was not necessarily in the means by which they worshiped. But the thing that separated the religion of the Bible from the surrounding religions was that it was based on the revealed moral will of God. I take it then for any man or woman who seeks to represent Jesus Christ that one of the things that we must take seriously is that God has revealed his will. And that if we are going to be faithful to the calling and to the mission, we must take that revealed God, moral will of God seriously. That means that for us to be effective in our ministry, we need not only to know the Bible, but we need to apply the Bible to people in modern life. James Cleland, in his discussion of homiletics, says that the diagram for homiletics is not a circle with a single center. The diagram is an ellipse, two centers. One center in which we must give ourselves is the center of the Bible. We must be people of the Word who take it seriously and let it guide our thought, let it shape our sermons. But another center that we have to look at is the center of the men and women in the world, because we are taking this revealed will of God and applying it to them. John Stott, in his book, Between Two Worlds, has as his controlling metaphor a bridge. As you know, a bridge joins two land masses that are separated by a ravine or separated by a river. And so Stott argues that the preacher is like a bridge who stands between the ancient world where God has revealed his will and the modern world. And he stands there to bring them both together. To be an effective preacher, you have to be a citizen of two worlds. But I'd suggest that it is an even more demanding task than that. That to be a preacher of the scriptures, you have to be familiar with a number of different worlds. One world that we must enter if we are serious about this task of taking God's revealed moral will and applying it to people is we have to enter the Bible. We have to enter the world into which the Bible came. And we enter that world through the skills of exegesis. To be at home in that world, one of the things you need to know is the history of that world. When God revealed himself, he revealed himself to certain people living at a definite time in a particular period of history. And the revelation is given to them within that setting. And if I expect to know this word of God, I have to know it in the context to which it came before I can apply it to the context in which I live. My wife, Bonnie, and I live up in Gloucester, Massachusetts. And Gloucester was started in 1623. It's the oldest fishing community in the United States. As you might expect, there is in Gloucester a number of antique shops. One of the men in the community with a touch of humor has a sign. On one side of the sign it says, we buy junk. On the other side it says, we sell antiques. But there are a lot of folks who come up there in the summertime who are interested in the antiques. And if you visited Gloucester, I suspect you'd visit some of those stores. Imagine that you were walking through an antique store and you saw an old trunk. It is obviously weathered by the years and, curious, you open it. And inside you see fabric that has now been worn by the decades. Curious, you rub your hands along the fabric and you accidentally touch a lever and a compartment opens. And in that compartment you find a package of letters. They're obviously old, wrapped with a ribbon now faded. And so you delicately open them and you start to read. You recognize before very long that those letters were written by a young man to a young woman. You also recognize that he has gone off to war. The young woman may be a girlfriend. She may be a fiancée, maybe his wife. There is much in those letters you would understand. You'd understand the fear of the young man as he anticipated going into battle, the grief that he had as he thought of comrades that had fallen during a war. Other things you might not know, depending on where you came from. There would be references to the Battle of Bull Run, or references perhaps to the Battle of Gettysburg. If you did not know about our Civil War, there would be a great deal in those letters that you just could not comprehend. To understand those letters completely, you'd have to know the history in which they were written. The history out of which they've come. There's a way in which when we read the Bible, we are reading letters that were written in a distant day. And to understand that letter, to understand that revelation, you need to know the setting in which they came. You need to know the people to whom they were written, the reactions of the people who read them. In addition to understand that ancient world, you have to have some familiarity with its languages. Oh, I don't want to push that too hard. You can learn an amazing amount of the Bible by reading it in English, if you read it regularly. But there are advantages of knowing the original languages into which the revelation came. Because all thought is bound up in language. One advantage of knowing the languages of the ancient world is that it gives you an idea of what the translators were facing when they translated the scriptures. Good translators are by nature interpreters. And as they translate a section of scripture, they have to make hermeneutical guesses. And often the interpretation they bring to a passage determines the way the passage is translated. If you know the original languages, you can understand why one translator may talk about the love of Christ, and by the way he translates it, talk about our love for Christ, subjective genitive. Another one may talk about Christ's love for us, an objective genitive. To be able to make a decision, you have to understand the problem of the translator. And the difference between translations is seldom that this group of translators fell off the turnip truck and these folks really knew what they were doing. By the nature of it, the translator must be an interpreter, and to make a decision between translations, it helps you to know the original languages. It also helps you to know the languages to enter into the thought patterns of that distant world. Because language is not only a conveyor of thought, it is a shaper of thought. Language is not only a means by which we communicate, it's a means by which we think. Benjamin Lee Whorf was a noted linguist. He spent his life working with the Hopi Indians in our American Southwest. And Benjamin Lee Whorf discovered that the Hopi Indians were able to understand the theory of relativity when it was given to them. They were not a particularly educated people. But the reason that they were able to understand the theory of relativity, Whorf said, was because there is no time in the language of the Hopis. They do not think in terms of past, present, and future. In their language, everything is either happening here where they are or happening away from them. And Albert Einstein said he could not have thought of the theory of relativity in English. To be able to think of that theory, he said he had to understand German and mathematics. In fact, Whorf went on to say that out of that, the language shapes our thought. The Eskimos do not have a single word for snow. They have 17 words for snow. They have a word for snow falling, for snow hitting the ground, for snow beginning to freeze, snow beginning to melt. I mean, 17 words for snow. When Eskimos think about snow, they can really think about snow. Just as we do not have a single word for a bread product made from wheat. If I talk about bread, then you either think of those loaves stacked at the grocery store, the long loaves that they have in France. But you don't think about Twinkies, you don't think about donuts, you don't think about bear claws. But as we think about wheat products, we can really think about them. Language not only helps you communicate thought, it helps you to shape your thought. Grammar, when you study it at seminary, seems like a dull and almost senseless thing. But there are many people who go to seminary and study Greek grammar and learn in the process English grammar. I mean, you never knew there was in English an object of a preposition until you got it over in Greek. You said, well, you know, those folks seem so strange. They look at that language that way. If you can learn a language and understand that you can enter into the thought process of the people, that helps you to move into the ancient world. In addition to all of that, you also need to know the culture of those people. You can no more think apart from culture than you can think apart from language. I used to think that the cultural problems in the Bible were things like, greeting one another with a holy kiss. You could, substitute a hearty handshake. Came to realize that all of the Bible is within its own culture, and that you cannot think apart from your culture. I do the radio Bible class, and a while ago we were going through the book of Proverbs. In some ways, the book of Proverbs is a slam dunk when it comes to interpreting it and explaining it. It's wisdom literature. It borrowed from nations that surrounded it. But even in a book like Proverbs, you have cultural questions. You're told, for example, on a couple of occasions, not to co-sign a note. In fact, you're not just told about it, you're warned about it, to get out of it, do everything you can to be rid of it. Plead with the person. Don't rest until it's done. And the reason was that if you co-signed a note and the first person didn't pay and you couldn't pay, then you would be put into slavery. Your wife and your children would be put into slavery. In our day, we have chapter 11, chapter 7, bankruptcy. People do not get thrown into prison because they can't pay a note. That's probably a good idea, not to co-sign a note that you can't pay, but the consequences are not anything like they were in the ancient world. And you have to wrestle with that. If you try to imply to people today that this is going to happen to them, they know that that's not true. All kinds of questions. We are wrestling in the church today with the place of women in a local church. And however you think about that, part of what you must deal with is the whole question of culture. Is what Paul wrote in the pastorals, word to Timothy, is it defined by the culture? Is it controlled by the culture? Does it transcend culture? Those questions are not incidental. They are crucial if you're to understand what was going on in the ancient world. But not only do we have to enter the ancient world, the world of the Bible, a world that we come to understand by understanding something of its history, something of its language, something of its culture, but a second world into which you and I must enter is the modern world. This is the world that folks in homiletics are interested in. Now, this world, too, has a history. It has a culture. It has a language. The world in which we live came here through a process in history. And evangelicals, folks in our circles, have often ignored history. But the truth is that history has not ignored us. History has a way of setting the agenda. History has a way of knocking at the back door when you would like to escape out of the front door. You cannot ignore history. It presents the problems. I remember the first time I ever talked to someone that was thinking about getting an abortion. I was working with the Christian Medical and Dental Society back in the 1960s. And a medical student and his wife came to see me. He was in his third year of medical school. And his wife had become pregnant. He was looking forward to completing med school, taking an internship, going on and taking residency, in fact, two residencies. He had at least 10 years ahead of him. It was the worst possible time for them to have a baby. And they talked about whether or not it would be all right to have an abortion. That was 1967. Every state in the Union had laws against abortion. Colorado and Hawaii were a bit looser. They said that abortion could be had if a woman's life or health was at stake, or her mental health was at stake. At the end of that decade, the courts reinforced the laws of Colorado and Hawaii. Then the early 1970s, we had Roe versus Wade. Everything changed. Today, every year, about 1.5 million preborns are aborted. If the statistics are accurate, between 20 and 25% of the women in our culture have had an abortion. And they sit in your congregation. You may stand up on a Sunday morning and thunder like a prophet from Mount Sinai against the awful evils of abortion and talk about those who have had an abortion as being murderers. In the eighth row, five seats in, is a woman who's had an abortion. And you tear her apart. If you don't understand what has happened in our culture and you do not handle that problem pastorally, you can do as much damage as you hope to do good. You can ignore history. It just won't ignore us. I wish that the reasons that our churches were integrated, whether a group of Southern Baptist theologians or theologians from Gordon-Conwell or Dallas or Denver or Trinity got together in the 1950s and they studied the book of Ephesians and they found that the middle wall had been broken down between Jew and Gentile. And they said, you know, that would probably apply to African-Americans and whites. That's not how it happened. It happened because a woman by the name of Rosa Parks in Birmingham got tired of standing in the back of the bus when there were seats in the white section in the front. And one day when she was tired, she sat there, and that spark got the flame to go. I say it to our shame. It's been our churches and our seminaries that have been most reluctant to integrate. I say it to our shame because if we had been thinking biblically, and that had been the policy of the churches back in the 40s and the 50s, we could have transformed American life. But it didn't happen that way. Now we find ourselves with a divide between the races because culture has come in, because history has come in. And we have just followed history rather than scriptures. If you're going to think about this modern world, you have to think about the culture in which we live. Because we, too, are involved in a culture. When I think of a culture, I think of it like colored paper. The people in America may look at life through orange paper. People in Britain may look at it through brown paper. People in the Orient may look at it through green paper. People in another part of the world may look at it through yellow paper. There's a way in which we all see the same thing, but we don't see everything in the same way. It's very difficult to see your own culture unless you've had an opportunity to somehow step outside of it. But we are shaped by our culture. For example, in American culture, how do you preach the lordship of Christ in what we call a democracy or a republic? Every 2 years, the Congress people are let loose from Washington and they come back to ask for our vote. Every 4 years, there are campaigns going on asking for the vote of the American people. The president himself leaves the White House and comes to the states and asks people to re-elect him. Every 6 years, senators come and ask us to put them back into office. Well, how do you preach the lordship of Christ when all of our leaders are coming to us, pleading for us, for our vote, to put them into office or keep them in office? We don't really find it easy to realize that God is a despot, a benevolent despot, but a despot. And when you read the book of Acts, you are not reading people out running a campaign, asking folks to vote for God or vote for Christ. There are some people who think the doctrine of election is that God votes one way, Satan votes another, and we sort of cast the deciding vote. It's nonsense. In fact, as the preacher in Acts puts it, God has made him Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. It's as much a fact as the fact of gravity. And if you choose to ignore that fact, you'll go to hell. Just the way it is. It's almost impossible to say that in a culture like ours. We don't like the idea that God has that kind of power, and we certainly don't want to think that we're going to be judged because we don't give him our vote. How do you preach grace in a culture like ours? If you read Advertising Age, they have said that one of the things advertisers want to do is to convince us that we have a right to buy the product. There's still enough of the Puritan overtone in our culture that folks don't feel quite easy to spend money. So there have been all kinds of campaigns to convince you that you have a right to the product. Buick had that ad in which there's a light on in a building. All the other lights are off, and the voiceover says, "You've worked hard. You've gotten to the top. Now you deserve your prize." The light goes out, and then you see this lone figure walk out of the building. And over here, fortunately, under lights, there's a brand new Buick. And the voiceover says, "Get in, enjoy it. You deserve the prize." Or if you don't like that ad, take the ad that you get from McDonald's. McDonald's sings it to you. "You deserve a break today." How do you preach grace in a culture where everything from hamburgers to new cars, you deserve? And if everything in life you deserve, how do you preach grace that you don't deserve? No wonder people come to you and they're upset with God. What are you upset about? "Well, I don't think God has treated me fairly." And what they don't understand is that God does not owe us, God owns us. But in a culture like ours, that's extremely difficult for people to understand. To enter this culture and to enter it well, you need to understand its language. You need to know that the language of preaching is the language of the Volkswagen ad. It's the language of television. It's not coarse, not rough, but it is contemporary. You're speaking to people today in terms that they understand and in ways they understand. All kinds of people, when they come into church and begin to preach, take on a kind of stained glass voice. And they use the language of Zion. "Oh God, thou who sittest on the throne of the universe, we come to you, your subjects, beseeching you that you will undertake for us." Or another culture, "You suck air." But imagine what that preacher does when he leaves the church and on that Sunday afternoon goes to a McDonald's. And he says, "I would like to have two hamburgers, two Cokes, and an order of French fries." She will think he has gotten his brain unscrewed. When they come to church, those people in the secular culture, that's what they think about us. There are people who believe that preaching is yelling. You know where that came from? It came from 150 years ago, where they didn't have public address systems. You're talking to the person 15 rows back, you got to yell at them to hear it. And then in the modern world, we invented microphones. But no, that's the tradition. So people get in the pulpit and they scream at the audience. And then to really make a point, they really scream. Folks come in from the outside, they think, "I don't need that. Get off my case." I can hear you. You turn on television, they don't yell at you. You turn on television, they don't stand behind a huge pulpit. Turn on television, they just talk to you person to person. You don't think that has changed the way language works? You don't understand the modern world in which we enter. You need to be a student of it. I think it's Bainton in his introduction to Martin Luther, his life of Martin Luther. Says that every man, and he could have said every man and woman who has ever influenced their day for God, is first of all caught up in the current of that day, and then stands outside of it to speak a word of judgment and of grace. You've got to know that world. There's a third world that you have to enter, and that's the particular world in which you minister. It's the world at Fifth and Main. It's the world with the zip code. It's the place, the particular place God has called you to serve. While it's essential that as a communicator of God's truth, you know the currents that are sweeping across our culture, you need to know the place where you serve. The place where you serve has a history, sometimes a long history. And the people who sit there in front of you are aware of that history. When I was teaching at Dallas a number of years ago, we had the students in our department do projects. One of our students wanted to do a history of the church in which he was serving in East Texas. Well, since we couldn't think of anything else for him to do, we let him do it. This was about 1972. And so he went back and he looked at the history of the church. Found that in the 1950s, a young black man had been accused of raping a white woman, and he had been taken by a group of vigilantes and burned on a cross on the lawn of that church. Something the pulpit committee never mentioned when they called him. Several years later, in the middle of the 60s, that church split. In a small town, if a church splits, everything splits. Families split. Businesses split. People in the town become enemies of each other. And so this fellow went out and, you know, he'd go door to door, invite people to come. Many of those people could still see the cross in the yard, and others knew about that split. He didn't know about it. History, part of that situation. It's amazing what history does. You come and you are going to come out of seminary with fresh new ways of reaching this community for Jesus Christ. These folks in these churches have been there for a lot longer than you've been there, and they've had all kinds of preachers come out with new ideas, and they've gotten them started, and then they've gone on to better things. They're not about to jump up and cheer for you. In fact, social scientists say it takes about 5 years to really get to know a church, and the average Protestant pastor changes churches every 2.5 years. I have no idea the history. You need to know the culture. This is breaking up, isn't it? You need to know the culture. Your town has a culture. Your place has a culture. You need to know the language. Just a way of talking. When I was the president of Denver Seminary, we had a student who was up in Wyoming. And he had a church in Wyoming of about 350, 375 people in a town that had about 200. I mean, you want to talk mega church, that's what you have up in Wyoming. I went up to be with him, and he said, Prof, spend some time with me doing some pastor work. We got up at 6 in the morning. We went down to a local restaurant, and he sat in the booth and ordered some coffee, some breakfast. Everybody came in. Hey, Henry, how you doing? How's that calf? Gonna make it? Yeah, good. Hey, Bruce, how's the crop gonna be this year? You think that cold spell we have is gonna hurt it? Hey, Larry, you get that new tractor? Boy, I think that must make the job a lot, a whole morning. About 10 of 9, we quit, went home. He said, That's how I do my pastoral work. Everyone in that community knew him and knew he cared. In fact, he said to me, one of my worst nightmares is to think that one day in the harvest season, you'll come to visit our church and you'll sit in the back row and you'll listen to me preach. And he said, the honest truth is that a couple of times during the harvest, I'm only able to give it an hour's preparation. I get out with those men and I bring in that harvest. He said, I'm kind of ashamed of my sermons, but he said, I just know they listen to me better the rest of the year when I'm out in the fields with them during the year. He knew his community. He could speak their language. He knew the language of farming. In order to be able to minister, you know your own particular area. But there's one other area, and that is the area that you can easily overlook. It's represented by these figures within the circle. Because another world that you inhabit that you almost don't think about is your world. The world inside of you. World that's been shaped by your history. The family out of which you've come. The area of the country in which you grew up. The conflicts. Whether or not you're an older child, a middle child. You come out of a different, may come out of a different culture. Some people come out of a drug culture. Some come out of the culture of Southern California. You have a kind of language inside your head. When things go wrong, you talk to yourself. Sometimes you're constantly criticizing yourself. For instance, it's interesting that in studies that are done, they find that a significant number of people who go into the ministry are either only children or first children. And many people go into the ministry, often come out of homes that are somewhat perfectionistic. It's the kind of home in which if you get the 3 A's and a B, your parents says, how come you didn't get 4 A's? You work hard, you get 4 A's, and your parents says, there must be something wrong with the school system. You get A's that easily. All your life, you keep trying to live up to their ideals. There's some of you who are doing that. Some of you may have daddies who have died 15 years ago. You're still trying to please them. And you bring that into ministry. In fact, you bring that into ministry in such a way that people who grew up in those homes often have a kind of underlying anger. And as a result, when they get up to preach, that comes through. These are the kind of folks who major in guilt. Anything they talk about, they end up with guilt. They can take the most exalted passages of the New Testament and lay a guilt trip on the congregation. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has begotten us into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible, undefiled, that fadeth not away, that's kept in heaven for you, who are kept by the power of God. I mean, that's exalted. That's positive. That's hope. This preacher gets hold of it and says, you don't have that hope, do you? You don't really live up to it, do you? Every time people go to church, they've raised the bar on them. This is the kind of preacher who, all the good guys lived in the first century. Paul was a good guy. He was devoted. John, he was filled with love. All of the louses live in the 20th century, and they're in my church. It's almost impossible for them to commend someone in their own congregation. They want an example of love and devotion. It's at least Martin Luther or before. They could not say, when I think about this virtue, I think of Harry. You all know Harry. You know the kind of thing he is. They couldn't do that for the world. I don't know a lot about raising kids. I got two, and they didn't go to the penitentiary. But I do know this. I do know this. To raise children, you got to give them 10 attaboys for every you jerk. And you get that turned around, and you're on their back and not on their team, you'll destroy them. I don't know much about running a seminary. I was the president of one for 12 years. Escaped with my life. I do know this, that part of being an administrator is that you find people doing something good and you tell them. rather than find people doing something wrong and you criticize them. Some people can't do that. Some men could not put their arm around their son and say to him, son, greatest gift God ever gave me was you. I want you to know I'm proud of you. I want you to know there's probably nothing you could ever do that would cause me to not really have you as the center of my affections. Some men couldn't do it. If that is the case of a person in his family, he ought never be allowed in the pulpit. His history has destroyed him. No, what you bring to the ministry is you. When you go to interpret the text, you are a part of that interpretation. There is some truth to the fact that between the interpreter and the text, there is some meaning. So that you bring insights to the text that I don't have. A woman will read the text differently than a man. So that you are there. That's why it's wise to sometimes take an exam, a psychological exam. Find out what you are, who you are, where your tendencies are. I think that while it's true that theology fashions us, it's also true we select our theology. I think I could give a test, a psychological test, and I could spot in a congregation the folks who were strong Calvinists. I don't mean people who believe in the 5 points of Calvinism. I mean the kind of person, if you're with them 15 minutes, they're talking about sovereign grace. I think I could also, with that same test, find folks who are strong Arminians. One mistake and you've lost it. That's what makes them run. Out of the infinitude that is God, we often choose our theology. It's true with me. I grew up in the ghetto of New York City, an area called Mousetown, a section of New York that Reader's Digest said was the toughest section in the United States. It was an area known for its viciousness and vice and its violence. And there are two doctrines that hold me. One is depravity, the depravity of men and women. I believe that all of us suffer from a curvature of the soul, that all of us have a polluted bloodstream. I wonder sometimes if I've ever done anything out of a completely pure motive. I believe depravity is the best proved doctrine of the Christian faith. President of a seminary, nothing there changed my theology. One good thing about believing in depravity is no one ever disappoints you. When I get to talking to people on the outside who say to me that they believe that all of us are inherently good, there's a blip now and then that's bad, but we're all inherently good, I have a hard time talking to them. Have you ever talked to somebody who believes in a flat earth? Got into a discussion with a man several years ago. He believed in a flat earth. We were in a restaurant. Flat earth? You don't mean it's round? No, it's flat. I said, well, how do you explain the fact that we had astronauts go around the Earth? He said, no, they didn't go around. That's what they went around this way. I didn't know what to say to him in a restaurant. I mean, I just didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to refute a man who believed in a flat Earth. What do you say to him? I don't know what to say to people who believe everybody's inherently good. Boy, I mean, they don't know themselves. They don't read the morning headlines. I don't know what it's about. I believe that. Other thing I believe in the depths of my soul is the grace of God. I believe God's grace is at work. And everything you see that's worth seeing is a result of His grace. A man I know of in East Texas is going through a depression. Lived in the Tyler area. Tyler says it's the rose capital of the world. He was sitting on the back porch of his house one Sunday, and he was really down. He said it was really the depths of where he was at. And he looked out, and he saw his wife's roses. She grew roses. As he sat there, he could He could smell manure the day before. His wife had had a man in the town deliver a load of manure and put it on her bushes as fertilizer. So he sat there, he saw the manure, he saw the roses, smelled the manure. And suddenly it dawned on him that God grows roses out of manure piles. And he said that was the beginning of the change. I believe that. In fact, I think when you go into ministry, your task is to find the roses. And if you can't stomach the smell of manure, you better leave. A lot of it out there. But God grows roses out of manure piles. I believe in the doctrine of depravity, the doctrine of grace. But those are not the only doctrines of the Christian faith. I need to be around other people who hold other doctrines with the same kind of strength. I need them. They need me. I need the correction in my life. Comes because my history is my history, but it's not the whole history. One of the important parts of ministry is to know who you are. The ancient world, the modern world, the particular world, you've got to know that world inside of you. And sometimes when you look at the dimension of the task, you say to yourself, who is sufficient for these things? And the answer is none of us. If God is not at work in our lives and in our thinking, we really don't enter into what it means to love Him with our hearts and souls and strength and mind. And if we don't have His enabling power, it'll come to nothing. But the good news is, you don't have to go it alone. The God who called you will enable you. And you can bet your ministry on that. Let's pray. Father, help us to see you in your word. Help us to see people in their need. Help us to see the ministries in our hands as our calling. And help us to open ourselves to you for the changing work of your Spirit. Amen. You're dismissed.